minutes ago. Looking real good in my passport photo.
Oh no.
15-hour flight. Oh, I don't think I'll ever be coming home. You know I love it.
Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have one news story for you. This one caught my attention. There is a new way that they're planning on identifying people in airports, and that is by the shape of their ears. Apparently, your ear is as distinctive to you as your fingerprint and a lot more easy for most of us to see. Bad news for those of you who are sensitive about the shape of your ears. I'd like to welcome back to the show Beth Whitman from Wanderlust and Lipstick, who's come to talk to us about Papua New Guinea. Beth, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris. I'm really excited.
And I say welcome back. Beth did an episode of The Amateur Traveler on traveling to India as a woman, which was one of my favorite episodes, so you might want to check out that episode. Now, Papua New Guinea is not like Cancun. It is doesn't get a lot of spring break traffic, and it's pretty far to go. What got you to Papua New Guinea?
Well, it's actually great spring break travel for the Australians, because there are a lot of Australians that go there.
Okay.
And it's a huge destination for diving. But my personal interest probably started maybe 25 years ago or so, and I cannot tell you the exact moment, but I'm sure that it was a National Geographic moment where a photo of these tribesmen all decked out in their traditional clothing, and I just thought, that is a place that I have to go. So it has been kind of in the back of my mind for years. And I finally had an opportunity to go there just over a month ago. And it has been on my mind every single day since. It's a completely fascinating country. Just amazing.
Actually, you'd mentioned Australia. Before we go much further, could you put Papua New Guinea on the map for us?
Oh, yeah. Actually, that's a great point. So it is located just north of Australia. And it's an island. It's actually half of an island. And the other half is Irian Jaya, which is a part of Indonesia. So here it is sitting in the South Pacific, just half of an island. It's actually, they say, the size of California. So it is rather large, you know, very much coastal. And then the interior is thick, thick jungle, impenetrable jungle area through most of it.
Beth and I were talking, she was asking if I knew Papua New Guinea. I actually had friends who lived there for a while, and they were there with a group that was doing translation. They were doing translation of the Bible. It was a Christian group. But how many different languages are there in Papua New Guinea, in New Guinea? I don't know what the number's the same.
Yeah, they're saying in Papua New Guinea, there are about 850 different languages. Now, the interesting thing about that is that these tribes, who all have very distinct languages and cultures, literally, up until very recently, they could not communicate with one another because the languages were so very different. And oftentimes, they were so isolated that they didn't know of a tribe that was living a half a mile away because they couldn't get through the jungle. They really just stayed in their own little areas and couldn't travel beyond that. So they didn't know that there were other people. They could never communicate with these other people. That's changed quite a bit since the missionaries have come in. They've created kind of this, well, they call it pidgin language. And it's a language similar to English, but not quite English. And many of the people now speak that pidgin language, and they can communicate with each other better than they ever have been able to.
Well, and obviously when you find 850 languages in that smaller region, it really tells you just how difficult the terrain is.
Well, yes, that's absolutely right. But the strange fact about this, and cultural anthropologists cannot figure this out, is that in the areas where the jungle is the thickest, there's more commonality in the languages.
Hmm.
And then in the areas like up in the Sepik, which is one of the main rivers that traverses up in the northern part of the island, where people could float around and get from village to village more easily, the languages are more distinct, and they can't communicate with each other. And as I said, cultural anthropologists can't figure out why this is, that it should be the opposite, but it's not. But it's not so easy to get around, let's just put it that way. And that's for travelers, too. It's really hard for travelers as well.
Now, I had an uncle who visited New Guinea, but he visited there as part of the U.S. Army in World War II. I'm suspecting your itinerary was a little different from his. Where all did you go in the island?
Yeah, it probably wasn't much different because it is so hard to get around. There's really, it's not quite a well-worn path, but most people go up to the highlands. Mm-hmm. And I was actually there for one of the big festivals. It's called the Mount Hagen Show. It's a big sing-sing. That's the local word for it. It's where everyone comes and sings and dances. And at this particular one, there were about 70 tribes from around the island, around the country, who participated. So I was in Mount Hagen, and then I was along the coast in the southeast part of the country in an area called Alatau. And then I was just in Port Moresby in the capital for a short time. And the other place where many people go is, as I mentioned, the Sepik. I haven't been there yet, but I'm just itching to get back and travel to that area as well. So most people, when they go on a trip there, it's usually an organized tour because it is so difficult to get around, and it's actually not the safest country in the world. That's just the bottom line, plain fact. But most people will go to the Sepik, they'll go up into the highlands, and they'll go somewhere along the coast there as well and either get some diving in or just some relaxation time on the beach.
You were actually doing this trip, as I recall, in preparation for a Wanderlust and Lipstick tour to New Guinea.
Yes, I'm actually working on that. And I'm planning to bring a group back there for the Mount Hagen Festival next August 2011. And details are slowly coming together for that. The interesting thing about the country is that there's really not a lot of cohesiveness. So, I mean, this just goes back for, what, 30, 40,000 years. Because people aren't used to working together, there's only one, basically, tour company that's based in the country that can pull together a tour. And so for me, if I don't use that company, and they're quite expensive, so I'm trying to avoid that. If you don't go through that company, then you've got to kind of cobble everything together and work with all these different in-country tour operators and the airlines and that sort of thing. So it's a bit of a challenge, but I like a challenge, and I like the fact that it is a little bit on the difficult side because it means it's not going to be just overrun with tourists anytime soon. There's always going to be a little bit of exclusivity because of that.
And since you're trying to get people interested in going to Papua New Guinea, what are the highlights? What are some of the things that really stand out in your memory?
My personal interest lies mainly with the tribes. I am fascinated by indigenous tribal cultures, and it's always been that way. I've always been interested. I've spent about 8 months in Australia, and it's the Aboriginals that I'm so fascinated with, and it's the Native Americans in the U.S., and it's, you know, anytime I go somewhere, I want to learn about these indigenous cultures. So really, for me, it was about these amazing cultures who literally, they have been living the same way for 30, 40 years until they were, quote-unquote, discovered by the outside world. The first ones in the highlands were discovered in the 1930s. So they're relatively untouched, rapidly changing, but just recently found in these areas. And that is so fascinating to me. They're beautiful. They're wearing costumes. And well, I call them costumes. That's not a fair word because it's their traditional dress. They're wearing these traditional clothing, grass leaves and shells, and painting their body like you wouldn't believe, and designing their hair in these fancy wigs. I mean, you just have to see the photos to be able to grasp this, but they are completely fascinating. And that's my personal interest, but there's so much more about Papua New Guinea. It's a big bird watching destination because they've got such a high concentration of unique birds there. And that goes with all sorts of wildlife. A lot of people go there to dive and to snorkel because it's some of the best in the world. There's surfing there as well. And then you had mentioned someone being there during the war. There's the Kokoda Track, which is a trek that many of the Australians, there's a big significance for the Australians for this particular trek through the middle of the country. I think it's like a 10-day trek. So a lot of people go there to hike and trek around the region. So it's really diverse, and it might sound trite, but there really is something for everyone, I think. So
there's no truth to the rumor that you like to hang out with indigenous tribe people because it makes you feel taller then?
No, they're actually much taller and bigger than me. Yeah, I hang out in Asia for that. Yeah, at 5'2", I'm always the tall one around.
So what was the day on your trip that really stands out? What did you do?
It was the first full day that I was there, and I went to a special event. It was kind of a pre-show for the Mount Hagen Festival. And so there's a gentleman up in the Hagen region who had put together a small, intimate show of about 10 groups. And myself and a number of other people, a small number of people, got to this location. We arrived early, like a big field. And we sat for hours and walked around for hours and got to watch these folks putting on their makeup and their traditional outfits. And that, to me, was the highlight. I couldn't have predicted that. I had no idea that that was going to be part of the tour that I was on, part of the itinerary. And it was the absolute highlight, just being in the midst of these people that I had kind of dreamed about for 25 years. And here I am standing there with them dressing themselves in these amazing paintings, just artful paintings on their faces, and primping themselves with grass leaves and hanging these shells on their necks. And for me, just life doesn't get any better, you know, than that particular day. It was the best. It was the pinnacle, I think, of my travels ever.
Interesting. And you've gotten around a fair amount, as we've talked over the years.
I have been around a little bit.
Yeah.
And that was it for me. That really was it.
Now, you went in August to see this festival and are going back in August. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a tropical country. Is August also a good time from a weather point of view, or is that just when the cultural event that you wanted to go to was?
Well, that's when the cultural event happens, but the weather is pretty stable for most of the year. So up in the highlands, it's very hot and humid, and we had daily showers up there. And I think that's pretty typical throughout the year. And then the coastal area is going to be pretty much the same year round. It's going to be pretty nice weather for the most part, sunny. And then I think probably maybe August, September-ish in the fall time, you'll have a little bit more of the rain showers. But for the most part, it's going to be humid, hot, rainy up in the highlands, and beautiful on the waterfront side.
You mentioned that you had been kind of looking forward to this trip for years. What was the biggest surprise?
You know what? The biggest surprise to me was the fact that it was a lot safer than I was anticipating. I don't know if the folks that you've spoken with who've been there have mentioned this, but as I said earlier, it's not the safest of destinations. And I had all sorts of things going on in my head about how dangerous it was going to be and what might happen to me. And I didn't experience that. I experienced the warmth and the generosity of the people. And an example of that is I got off the plane in Port Moresby, and I had been sitting next to a gentleman who was a national, a local from Papua New Guinea, and waiting for my luggage to be unloaded from the plane. And these two women came over and started chatting with me. And the one woman pointed and said, "Oh, that's my husband." And she pointed to the gentleman who sat next to me on the plane. And she was just so interested in me. She was touching my face and my hair. I've got long blonde hair and my skin, you know, my fair skin. And they were just so interested and so nice. And I wasn't expecting that much warmth. And I experienced that throughout the trip, just that people were so friendly and so helpful and so warm. Now, having said that, you want to be careful, you know, when you travel there. You don't venture out on your own. You don't go out in the streets of Port Moresby by yourself. You've got to have a guide. So there are facets of that that place, Papua New Guinea, of more than any place I've been to, you do really want to take a lot of precautions. But there's this whole other aspect where the vast majority of people are so warm and friendly and just absolutely lovely. And I didn't know what to expect. And so that was the big surprise for me.
Now, let's get a little more detail. When you're taking a guide, you're concerned for your physical safety, and we're talking about a place that's generally gotten away from cannibalism, but it's not that many generations away. So what kind of physical concerns are there?
Well, they have a very high unemployment rate. And so what happens is the younger people from these tribes leave their communities, they leave the highlands, and then they head down into one of the three main cities, Port Moresby, Mount Hagen, or Leh. And they arrive there thinking that they're going to have a better way of life, they're going to find work, and that's just not the case. So they kind of band together. They become what's called rascals. And so everyone in Papua New Guinea knows what a rascal is. And these are young men, I'm assuming young, that head out after dark, and they're probably liquored up and potentially, you know, on drugs, and, you know, are causing physical harm. They're robbing people, they're breaking into homes, they're breaking into apartment buildings. They're hurting people on the streets. If you're walking around on your own on the streets, especially if you're a woman, I think there's the potential for rape. Now, I haven't heard stories about tourists being raped, but I have heard stories and read stories about the locals, that happening to locals. But it's generally burglary, theft, taking your money. So you want to play it safe. You don't go out after dark, and you have a guide with you during the day when you are out. And you go to safe areas. You know, you go with someone who knows where to take you and what places to avoid.
Now that we've gotten some of the bad news out of the way.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sad reality.
Sure. But I didn't want to gloss over it as...
Exactly.
Because right. I know that just to calibrate this, this is somebody we're talking to who will go to India traveling solo, as we've talked about before, which a lot of people are intimidated by. So Beth is not easily intimidated. So
right.
When Beth is taking a guide with her, I thought was worth pausing there for a second and making sure we understood that.
Well, and you know what's interesting is that... So I had an escort during my trip. My escort was from Port Moresby. And when we got to Mount Hagen and she wanted to go to the local market, we got a guide. We got a local security guard from our hotel to bring us, because even she, you know, hadn't been to the market, wasn't comfortable, wasn't aware of what might happen there. So we had a third person with us. So I think it's a pretty natural thing that everybody's kind of watching out for each other. And they, you know that if you're not from the area, then you have a local person help you out.
Okay. I'd like to try something new. If you close your eyes right now and think of Papua New Guinea, what does it sound like?
Oh, my goodness. It's banging drums and singing. And what happens at these shows, and I love that exercise because I can be transported back there immediately. What happens is, these groups come out into this big, like imagine a big football field. These groups come out one at a time in these big fields, and they have maybe 5 or 10 minutes to show off to the people in the stands. And so they're dancing and singing on their own, showing off their own song and dance. And then once everyone has come out to the field and had their few minutes of fame, then everyone joins in at the same time. And as a guest at one of these shows, like at the Hagen show, you get to walk through and photograph and listen to all of it. And you have everyone singing and dancing and banging on these drums at the same time. So sometimes it's hard to distinguish who's singing what, but it's full on everybody at once. And they're all trying to outdo each other. And it's just great because they're competing. This is also a little competition for them. So they are all just going at it at the same time. And that's what I hear. And that's what I see when I close my eyes and think about Papua New Guinea.
And we talk about seeing what photographs that you took captured the country for you.
Well, the ones that come to mind are the ones, these close-up shots of these tribal folks in their traditional outfits. And the interesting thing about that is that someone asked me recently, was it hard to take photographs? You know, did they mind? They actually were upset if you didn't take their photograph. It was a source of pride for them to have their photo taken. So if you walked by with your camera and maybe gave them a glance and then kept looking, there was a visible look of disappointment on their face. And I picked up on that pretty quickly. And I thought, okay, I've got to start photographing everybody because I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings because they do all look magnificent. But yeah, it's an easy place for a photographer. It's like a candy shop.
This is a question I'm interested to hear your answer for. So we're talking about a culture that is in fairly rapid change here over the last 100 years. When did you feel most at home, and when did you feel furthest from home?
I don't think I ever felt at home. I mean, you know, sitting in my hotel room watching CNN, you know, for 5 minutes, maybe that was it. I think a foreigner, a tourist, will always feel like a fish out of water in that country. I would love to ask that question of an expat to find out. People who I had met, one gentleman who'd been living there for like 25 years, I would love to know if he ever feels at home. But I don't know that I ever really felt at home there. Not that I felt uncomfortable or concerned. I was just always aware that this was so off the charts different for me, that nothing felt familiar necessarily. And an experience that was far from home. Well, I'll tell you, I'd been fascinated by the Huli Wigmen. And this is a community that lives up in the highlands. And the Wigmen leave for long stretches of time. They might leave for years. They leave their families and they go off into the forest. They go to this private location and they grow their hair. So imagine leaving for 6 months and you've got this big, like, afro, basically. They've got this big head of hair growing. And it's not clear to me whether, so I think sometimes the hair gets shaved off and then sometimes it's actually part of their head. It's attached. But they learn, it's like they go to this university, this private little university in the woods, and they learn how to primp the hair so that it's in different styles. So it might look like a saucer, like one of those saucers that you use, like your kids would use in the snow. So it's like this big round saucer. And there's other ones that look like Viking horns. And it's just really bizarre. And I didn't go to this particular village, but I saw these, the Huli Wigmen at this festival. And I was so ecstatic. So that was such a highlight for me. And then I get to Port Moresby and I have a guide, a local guide for the day, someone to show me around Port Moresby. His name was Andrew, and it's not that we got off on a rocky start, but we just, like, we weren't quite communicating about maybe what I wanted to do in Port Moresby, and we were driving around trying to figure it out. And then we started talking, and he said, well, I come from Huli. And I said, you're a Wigman? And he said, yes, I'm a Wigman. And so then we just completely connected. We completely clicked. And here I am. I'm so far away, and here I've been watching these videos at home of these Huli Wigmen. And here I am sitting in a car with a Huli Wigman, and he's showing me photos of his kind of former life in the village. And I mean, how strange is that to be, I don't know how many miles I am away from home, 10,000 miles away from home, and transplanted into my kind of fantasy world. And oh, it's just such a complicated thing. You know, here you've got this Huli Wigman who's given up his past life basically to go be an English-speaking guide in Port Moresby. And here I am fascinated by the Huli Wigman. And I end up in this guy's van as he's showing me around this city. It was a really strange moment for me. And like I said, it's just complicated. The whole thing, they are moving so fast and they're changing so quickly that the whole thing is just so strange to me. And that was a perfect example of it. It was kind of like synchronicity, me being there with this particular guide, and yet it just all lined up. It was all just perfect.
When you talk about strange, what was one thing when you saw it, you had to laugh to yourself and say, only in Papua New Guinea?
Oh, I've got a great story for you. So this is great. My first dinner with my escort, her name was Tida, lovely woman from Port Moresby. We were having dinner up in Mount Hagen, and we had both ordered barramundi, you know, just ordered off the menu at the hotel restaurant. She ordered, and then I said, I'll have the same thing. So the waiter took our order and left. And
barramundi's a fish. I don't remember the details.
Right. So the barramundi is a fish, right. And it was a nice, it looked good, looked like it was going to be a nice meal. In the meantime, we had a couple of other people join us at our table and they ordered their meal and they brought Tida's barramundi and the waiter walked away. And then he brought the other gentleman's, you know, these two guys with us, he brought their food. And here I'm sitting with no food in front of me. And I said, you know, do you think that they forgot my meal? And so she asked, and indeed, the chef saw barramundi and he didn't see that it was two orders. So he just cooked the one. And so that in itself was a little strange, you know, that he wasn't really reading the ticket. But then for the waiter to come bring everyone's meal but mine and not even blink an eye as to why I wasn't eating, you know, and that is really typical in a very sweet way. It's very typical of what happens in Papua New Guinea, that these folks are not well trained in the service industry. They're learning, and I cut them big slack for this. It's going to be a process for them, and I understand that. But that is really typical, that the service in most places is just not very good. And we're talking, Papua New Guinea is very expensive. I think my hotel room was $400 and something a night.
Oh my goodness.
And, right. And that kind of service was not worthy, you know, of a $400+ a night hotel. Lovely people, really lovely people, but just they don't understand the training, you know, and that cropped up quite a bit. We would have to ask for things over and over because they just weren't used to service. They just weren't trained in it. And that'll change over time. But that is definitely only in Papua New Guinea, for
now,
sure.
You mentioned $400 a night. Is there a less expensive option? I can't picture that you're staying in the five-star hotels just because that's what you love.
Yeah, this wasn't a five-star hotel, for sure. Yeah, it was not five-star hotel quality at all. It was five-star prices. I don't think, no, I was there during a big festival, so the prices were beefed up quite a bit. But the prices are very expensive countrywide because there are so few options and because there is so much mining and timber money that's being poured into the country that a lot of these folks are there on business, that the hotels can charge these prices because there's a lot of money coming in there that's business related. And I just don't know. I'm sure that there are probably some less expensive places to stay. I don't know how safe they are. And I can tell you that there are more expensive places to stay as well. I would say that $400 was probably pretty average. Yeah.
What is your best money saving tip if you're spending $400 a night for a hotel?
Go off season. Yeah, that's really the only option, is to go off season. You're not going to have the choices in terms of kinds of accommodation. You know, you're not going to have a choice of 100 different hotels to pick from. But if you go off season, then the prices are going to drop some. The other thing is that you can go to Papua New Guinea on your own. It is not safe to do that. It just isn't safe. You really need to have a guide with you wherever you go, kind of watching your back. And it's really best to have somebody who knows the country, who's just kind of can give you some ideas of what to watch out for. And I'm not just trying to give a plug for my own potential trip, you know, my own tour.
Oh, no.
I'm just saying, no, seriously, I'm just saying, like you said, I'm the first person to say, go out there and travel as much as you can, do it solo, do it independently. Like, I run tours, but I do that as a convenience. And basically, because that's like, people have asked me for these trips, and I do Bhutan, which, you know, you have to go there.
Right. Have to have a guide.
Exactly. But really, if you're going to go to the country, you really need to be set up, because you just don't want to get yourself into a sticky situation, because it's not good. It really is not good.
Okay. As we start to wind this down, if I go to Papua New Guinea, what is one thing I need to remember to pack and one thing I need to remember to taste?
Ooh, you need to pack protein bars. That was the best piece of advice that I got. I mean, besides the camera and your video camera, and you're going to bring that, bring protein bars. That was the best piece of advice that I received. And as a vegetarian, you know, it's always good for me to have that little bit of backup for myself. But the other thing that I found is that when you're out and you're in amongst these 70 tribes and it's the middle of the day and you're getting hungry, you don't want to have to go someplace and go find your meal, find your boxed lunch or your sandwich or your fruit. You want to have something right there so you don't have to go take a break. And that worked out really well for me, just not only to have that backup protein, but to not be so reliant on where my food source was going to come from. And the thing that you have to taste is a traditional, it's a mumu. It's the underneath the dirt way that they cook, like a cooking oven. And they do it in Hawaii as well.
So this is like Kalua in Hawaii, Kalua pig or something.
Okay. Exactly, right. So they dig a hole and they put lots of potatoes and their root vegetables in there and pigs. They put it all in and they'll cover it up and then they cook it.
These would be New Guinea pigs.
Right, exactly. So they'll cook that all up and then you've got to taste that. And that's what you've got to try, some of the local food and the coconut too. Delicious coconut.
Now, I did want to point out that barramundi is not a vegetable, but I think you knew that already.
I did. And you know what? Sometimes I bend my rule, my vegetarianism, when I don't feel like I have any options or I want to be nice to the locals too.
We've got two more questions for you, but anything else that we should know before we go to Papua New Guinea?
Yeah, you know what? I'll tell you that it's not for everybody. I came home and told my husband all these great stories about this fabulous place and just how it just took me away. And he just said, I don't know. I don't think I want to go there. So it's not for everybody. But for somebody who's interested, and I know it's on a lot of people's lists, it's a must. You've got to go. If you have an inkling of trying to get there, you got to go.
Okay. Last two questions. Finish this sentence for me. You really know you're in Papua New Guinea when what?
When your dinner doesn't arrive as ordered.
I think I've been to Papua New Guinea then, but.
Yeah. You know you're in Papua New Guinea when, this could be parts of Seattle too, when you're seeing people with bird feathers stuck through the septum of their nose and they're just walking around town like that.
So you're either in Papua New Guinea or Seattle at that point, okay?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. The Capitol Hill neighborhood of Seattle.
And if you had to summarize Papua New Guinea in three words, what three words would you use?
One word comes to mind, and that's just breathtaking.
Excellent. Beth, thanks so much for coming back on The Amateur Traveler. And where can people read more about your adventures?
Well, on my website, wanderlustandlipstick.com, and I have my own blog on the site. And I've been talking a lot about Papua New Guinea on there lately, so they can do a little search and find out lots of stuff and look at all the photos, too. That's just amazing. Just a photographer's heaven there.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for coming.
Hey, thanks for having me, Chris.
In news from the community, I had an email from Clara who said, just wanted to say I greatly enjoyed listening to the Gulf Coast episode this evening. It brought back great memories of my childhood family reunions in Destin, Florida, still one of my favorite beaches in the world. I thought it might be useful to point out that flying into the Florida Panhandle got much easier this year with the opening of a brand new airport in Panama City. Southwest is one of the carriers serving the airport, so there should be some decent competition to keep prices at an affordable level. Pensacola and Mobile, Alabama are good nearby airport options too. Clara, thanks so much for giving us that information. Also about that show, I heard from Joanne who said, Chris, I was so pleased to see you did a show on Northwest Florida. I discovered this wonderful family vacation area when my school-aged sons and I wanted to go to Florida for spring break. At the time, I couldn't afford three airfares, so we drove down from Wisconsin. We landed in the Panhandle simply because it was the Florida beach closest to Wisconsin. When my then 9-year-old son saw the beach with the white sand and the turquoise water after a boring 2-day road trip, he ran into the Gulf fully clothed, before I even unpacked his bathing suit. We were instantly in love with the place and returned several more times while they were growing up. I used to describe it as a place where you could drive the beach roads and still see the beach, unlike many other parts of overdeveloped Florida. Your guest forgot to mention the protected Gulf Island National Seashore on the western end of the Panhandle into Mississippi, which guarantees us all a chance to enjoy an uninterrupted view of this spectacular waterfront. Thanks, Joanne, for giving us that insight into the Florida Panhandle. With that, we're going to bring this episode of The Amateur Traveler to a close. If you have any questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at either Amateur Traveler or a much chattier version at Chris2X. As always, thanks so much for listening.